A signaling error has emerged as the likely cause of the recent train crash in India that killed nearly 300.
The issue is about the point machine and electronic interlocking. The change in the electronic interlocking caused this accident, and whoever did it and whatever the reasons will be known after the investigation.
Plus, the United States and China spent the weekend in Singapore pointing fingers at each other.
People's Republic of China continues to conduct an alarming number of risky intercepts.
To put it your way, mind your own business and take good care of your own people.
And the challenges facing America's Southwest as water levels drop in a crucial river. Today is Monday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A train was on the wrong track because of an electronic signaling system error, and that error led to a devastating train derailment in India that's killed nearly 300 people and injured more than 1,000. Rescuers and families searched through mangled train carriages on Sunday for more victims. Reuters' Alice Rizzo starts us off.
As workers clear up the remaining wrecked trains, preliminary investigations are pointing to a signal failure as the likely cause of the crash that killed hundreds of people in India's worst train disaster in decades and wounded over 1,000 more. Railway Minister Ashwini Vaishal was at the scene on Sunday.
The issue is about the point machine and electronic interlocking. The change in the electronic interlocking caused this accident, and whoever did it and whatever the reasons will be known after the investigation.
According to a preliminary investigation, one passenger train, the Coromandel Express, heading to Chennai from Kolkata, moved out of the main track and entered what's called a loop track, which is used to park trains, at about 80 miles per hour. It crashed into a parked freight train doing so. That crash caused the train to jump the tracks, topple, and hit another train heading in the opposite direction and at about the same speed, according to a member of the railway board. The drivers of both passenger trains were injured but survived. Indian authorities say they have now concluded rescue operations. At a business center where bodies were being taken for identification, dozens of relatives waited, many weeping and clutching identification cards and pictures of missing loved ones. Seema Chowdhury's husband was going to the city of Chennai to work on the evening of the crash. She is still looking for him at the center.
I have been to all the hospitals and have found out nothing. Now I'm going to Bhubaneswar to find out. I just need my husband. I don't want anything else.
Families of the dead will get 1 million rupees or about $12,000 in compensation, while the seriously injured will get 200,000 rupees with 50,000 rupees for minor injuries.
Alice Rizzo reports for Reuters News. The United States and China spent the weekend in Singapore pointing fingers at each other. The two countries' top military leaders accused each other of ratcheting up tensions in the Taiwan Strait during separate speeches at a summit meant to highlight unity. As VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, the heightened rhetoric follows increasingly tense training maneuvers in the region.
First, there was a Chinese fighter jet performing an in-air maneuver over the South China Sea late last month, rocking a U.S. reconnaissance aircraft in a move the United States called unnecessarily aggressive. Then, a few days later, in the Taiwan Strait, which separates Taiwan from continental Asia, a Chinese destroyer performed a maneuver bringing it close to a U.S. warship. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin called the move irresponsible, and the U.S. Navy called it unsafe. And thus, the stage was set for a war of words between the United States and China at this year's Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. The meeting is an annual gathering of the world's military brass and is a platform for networking and embracing de-escalation. Instead, both countries' military leaders exchanged barbs over recent events in the South China Sea, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin speaking as carried by the Associated Press.
People's Republic of China continues to conduct an alarming number of risky intercepts of U.S. and allied aircraft flying lawfully in international airspace. We will support our allies and partners as they defend themselves against coercion and bullying. To be clear, We do not seek conflict or confrontation.
Chinese Defense Minister Li Shangfu is provided by the Associated Press.
To truly avoid these incidents, the best way is for countries, especially naval vessels and fighter jets of countries, not to take closing actions around other countries' territorial sea and airspace. To put it your way, mind your own business and take good care of your own people.
Li had refused Austin's requests to meet at the summit. While China's defense minister essentially told the U.S. to pack up and go home, it was China earlier this year that sailed a spy balloon across the United States and Canada, gathering information on, among other things, U.S. military sites. Lawmakers say China has gone too far. Republican Congressman Mike Turner speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week.
You get this sort of sense of permissiveness that I think the administration needs to step up and make clear that China has identified itself as an adversary and we're going to treat it as such.
Beijing has for years pushed back on the United States' support of Taiwan, taking public offense at U.S. lawmakers welcoming the island's leaders, like House Speaker Kevin McCarthy recently did in California. The U.S. Department of State calls Taiwan a key partner in the region. China views the self-governing island as a renegade province. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
China has tightened access to Tiananmen Square in central Beijing on the anniversary of the 1989 pro-democracy protests. Elsewhere in Hong Kong, which had been the last Chinese-controlled territory to hold commemorations, police detained 32 people on Saturday and Sunday, many of them were taken away near Victoria Park. The large public space used to be the scene of an annual candlelight gathering to remember the hundreds or thousands killed when army tanks and infantry descended on central Beijing on the night of June 3rd and into the morning of June 4th back in 1989. On Friday in New York City, protesters set off from a nearby small park to the newly opened June 4th Memorial Museum.
34 years passed.
Pastor Bo Li Zhang, who was a participant of the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989, told VOA's China branch that 34 years had passed and that they think, back then, the pursuit of democracy was the same as it is today. For Chinese people, democracy is a goal that must be pursued from generation to generation, and that it can't be accomplished in one generation, but they must persist. In Beijing, additional security was seen around Tiananmen Square, which had long been ringed with security checks requiring those entering to show identification. We're following these other stories from around the world. Saudi Arabia and the United States have urged Sudan's battling parties to agree to and effectively implement a ceasefire, as the fighting in the northeastern African nation showed no signs of abating. Both Washington and Riyadh urge both sides to agree to a new ceasefire following the latest one, which expired late Saturday. An education official says nearly 80 girls were poisoned and hospitalized in two separate attacks at their primary schools in northern Afghanistan. It is thought to be the first time this kind of assault has happened since the Taliban swept to power in August of 2021. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says representatives from Turkey and Sweden will meet in just over a week to try to bridge their differences about the Nordic country joining the military alliance. Stoltenberg made no breakthrough on the membership impasse over the weekend. NATO wants to bring Sweden into the fold by the time Allied leaders meet in Lithuania in July. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A clinical trial by an Ohio State University-led team of researchers suggests that daily low doses of eye drops, normally used to dilate pupils for examination, may someday be used as drug therapy to slow the progression of nearsightedness in children. This condition makes it difficult to see distant objects without the use of eyeglasses or contact lenses. According to the National Institutes of Health, nearsightedness or myopia develops in young children and worsens through the teen years before easing. Researchers found that a low-dose drop of atropine in each eye every day was better than a placebo at reducing eyeglass prescription changes and elongation of the eye in nearsighted children from 6 to 10 years old. The NIH says the global incidence of myopia is rising, with an estimated 50% of the world's population having the condition by 2050. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Police say gunmen burst into a room at a men's hostel near the eastern South African city of Durban, killing at least 8 people and leaving 2 others injured. It's the latest mass shooting in the country. 7 men were declared dead immediately after the shooting in the pre-dawn hours of Saturday in the Umlazi township. Authorities say an 8th man died on Sunday. 2 others are hospitalized with injuries, and they include a man who jumped out of a window of the hostel room to escape the gunfire. Police said 12 men were in the room drinking alcohol when numerous gunmen broke in, shot at them, and then fled. 2 of the men in the room were unhurt. South Africa is among the 10 countries with the highest homicide rates in the world, and there has been a spate of mass shootings in recent years. Elsewhere, almost 2 dozen people have died from cholera just outside South Africa's capital of Pretoria. That's in recent weeks, and hundreds have been hospitalized. Critics blame government mismanagement and corruption for the rare outbreak. VOA spoke to residents who have been affected and officials who are still searching for the source of the cholera. Kate Bartlett has that story.
While cholera, a waterborne disease, might be common in other parts of Africa, it's unusual in South Africa, the most industrialized country on the continent. But almost 2 dozen people have died in recent days, and in this impoverished area just outside the capital, Pretoria, residents like Lerato Marota place the blame squarely on the government.
People are dying about cholera, so we are scaring now because of our water is very dirty.
She says her husband became sick from the water, but luckily recovered after going to the hospital. However, she says while this outbreak is new, the water has been dirty for years.
We blame the government because we can't blame anyone because the government, I mean, it's been a long time we were fighting to get the clean water, but they didn't say anything about it. I think it's corruption because they don't clean the water.
South African NGO Gift of the Givers is trying to stop the spread of the disease, distributing thousands of bottles of clean water and other aid to the community and to schools like this one. The NGO's Clifford Mabe says people are anxious.
There was an outbreak in Hammarskraal, so the people of Hammarskraal are panicking to drink the tap water.
The government has also set up this field hospital to take pressure off the main hospital in town, says Zina Bam from the Department of Health.
We promote people with any gastrointestinal symptoms or signs or problems that they come here, and then we do a triage out of them and then we give them treatment. So the treatment that we're doing on site is oral rehydration station, and then we put up intravenous therapy.
She said the government was still conducting tests to determine the source of the outbreak. Opposition parties have blamed government mismanagement for causing the crisis in the first place and say it's all part of South Africa's crumbling infrastructure. The worst electricity crisis in years has also been causing daily blackouts that are hitting the economy hard. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Hammanskraal, South Africa.
In addition, a humanitarian charity says that hundreds of refugees in Kenya's Dadaab camps have been affected by a cholera outbreak as the population in the facilities grows rapidly. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, said last month that more than 2,700 refugees have been affected so far and that there is an imminent risk of outbreaks of other gastrointestinal diseases. As Jakarta sinks by about 15 centimeters per year, ecotourism around the Indonesian capital is picking up as residents flock to nearby mangrove reserves to replant trees, which shield the city from rising tides. Reuters' Gabe Singer brings us that story.
Ecotourists in Indonesia are discovering the benefits of mangroves as the country pushes to conserve and replant coastal areas that have been decimated by human activity. Mangroves are vital for megacity Jakarta, which is one of the fastest sinking cities in the world, and where the trees play a vital role in holding off rising tides. As the sounds of the bustling city echo in the distance, Connie Sihombing paddles her way through the calm waters of a mangrove reserve park. Despite living in Jakarta, Connie says she never knew Angke Kapuk Nature Reserve Park existed within city limits.
I love nature. I've traveled far, yet I had no idea that close to home lies this fascinating and beautiful park.
The sanctuary makes up just a sliver of Indonesia's near 16,000 square mile mangrove area spread along the nation's coasts. Mangroves have been the main defense against the tide, but development along the coast, including construction of artificial beaches, is threatening the future of the mangroves. Last year alone, around 2,700 square miles of mangrove tracts fell to deforestation. In an attempt to offset the destruction, the Indonesian government has launched a program to restore thousands of square miles of mangrove tracts. But those results won't be seen for at least another 5 years, when the trees grow strong enough to hold off the ocean. In the meantime, the reserve park's vice director, Andika Danangputra, believes that ecotourism plays a crucial role in the effort to protect these vital wetlands. With each mangrove planted, he hopes that appreciation for the mangroves will grow and residents of a sinking Jakarta can breathe a little easier.
Gabe Singer of Reuters News. In North America, the Colorado River is an essential source of water for 7 southwestern U.S. states and northern Mexico. It supplies water for irrigation, drinking and power generation, as well as supporting ecosystems and recreational activities. However, the river is facing significant challenges due to drought, overuse, and climate change, which is leading to water shortages and potential conflicts among users. The Colorado River is important to the region, and sustainable management, as well as conservation efforts, are crucial for its future viability. John Jack Schmidt is the director of the Center for Colorado River Studies at Utah State University. I spoke with him via Zoom and asked him how things got to where they are today, and what needs to change.
Water is obviously a critically important resource anywhere in the planet, and especially important if you don't have any. I think if you think about the Colorado in an international perspective, you can think about the rivers of the planet that are big rivers that carry water from distant sources across semi-arid and arid landscapes where they're used to their entirety. The Colorado River has long been called the Nile of America. And it's just like the Nile. The fundamental problem is that we have a warming climate, which has led to decreasing runoff in the river system. And the river has been completely used. And so when the supply of water declines and you're already using every drop and the number of drops decreases, well, then suddenly you have a crisis.
But what about the rules governing water usage?
In the United States, thankfully, we're all in the same country, but we're still all in different states with different perspectives. And we have a set of laws negotiated a century ago. And those laws that were negotiated a century ago assumed we had a lot more water than we do. And so those rules sort of have encouraged use of absolute amounts of water that we no longer have. And we sustain those uses for 20 years in the 21st century, despite a declining supply, by draining the reservoirs.
You know, looking at the laws that are in place, and some of them are in the courts, and there's lots of discussions, competing interests as to who gets what water rights up and downstream. You know, was there no mechanism really built in place to the negotiations and the way that the water rights were developed over time that someone could put the brakes on, so to speak?
Yes. We built a car without brakes. We built a car without brakes in the sense that we assumed there was a fixed amount of water and that everybody got a fixed amount. And most importantly, California got a fixed amount. Arizona got a fixed amount. Nevada got a fixed amount. Now, the upper basin, they did proceed with a late, more recent agreement in which they each got a percentage of what was left over. But because there were fixed amounts in the lower basin, people kept using at those large amounts, and a fixed amount went to Mexico. In 2007, a little bit better breaks were built that called for some reductions in use in the lower basin. But that agreement in 07 did not allow the system to recover. And as soon as we got, every time we got a good year, we spent a little more. So we never rebuilt it. And that took us all the way to 2020. Then the system collapsed even further, and we did not have breaks in place to reduce. We had a couple short-term temporary agreements negotiated in the last couple of years, but they have been insufficient to take us back from the edge of crisis, although this winter does allow us to take a step or two back. But we've never had adequate breaks in place.
That was the director of the Center for Colorado River Studies at Utah State University, John Jack Schmidt. And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi recently reported that the situation at the Russian-occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, the largest in Europe, remains extremely fragile and dangerous. Military operations continue in the region and may well increase very considerably in the near future, he warned. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield noted that Russia continues to demonstrate its flagrant disregard for the safe operation of the Zaporizhia power plant.
Since March of last year, when Russia illegally seized the Zaporizhia plant, the international community has held its breath each time the facility has been hit by shells, each time it has lost external power. Each time Russian forces have detained essential staff. To make matters worse, recent news reports indicate that Moscow has disconnected Zaporizhia's vital radiation monitoring sensors, which means the plant's data is now being sent to the Russian nuclear regulator.
Russia's reckless actions stand in stark contrast to Ukraine's responsible behavior, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
Throughout this conflict, Director General Grossi has made clear that Ukraine has fully cooperated in implementing safeguards at all its nuclear facilities and that the IAEA has not found any indication of a proliferation concern in Ukraine.
There is no doubt that Russia's actions are an attack on the safety and security of the region and the world. And we must stand together and demand President Putin end this madness, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
If Russia wants to show that it is serious about reducing nuclear risk at Zaporizhia, it can take steps to remove its weapons and civil military personnel from the plant, maintain an uninterrupted power supply to the plant from the territory under Ukraine's control, provide a humanitarian corridor to rotate Ukrainian personnel at the plant, to reconnect the plant's radiation monitoring systems, and return full control of the plant to the competent Ukrainian authorities.
Ambassador Thomas Greenfield also expressed deep concern over Russia's stated intent to deploy nuclear weapons in Belarus. It is entirely within Moscow's control to avert a nuclear catastrophe and to end its war of aggression against Ukraine. The United States will continue to stand with the Ukrainian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.